Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, coronavirus testing continues to fall short. From the beginning, the federal government has failed to supply enough testing to fully treat and contain the COVID-19 public health crisis. A patchwork of testing systems has sprung up across the states to try and manage the situation. But public health officials say it's not enough. Last night, the White House announced a plan to increase coronavirus testing across the country, but left implementation to local leaders. My guest, Dr. Ashish Jha, says it still falls short. Dr. Jha is the director of the Harvard Global Health Institute. Dr. Jha, the White House announced a national testing strategy last night. Tell us, number one, what it says, and number two, your own reaction to it.
So it's nice to see the White House recognizing that we do need a national testing strategy. Unfortunately, the goals they set out for the number of tests necessary is wholly inadequate. We need to be doing a lot more than what they've said. And then the rest of it was quite vague. There just aren't details about how we're going to achieve those goals. So while it's nice to see them getting on board, I wish they had gotten a bit more ambitious and a bit more detailed.
So they call it a blueprint, but pretty much leaving it to the states to figure out how to do it.
It's vague overall in terms of what the federal role will be. They describe the U.S. federal government as sort of the supplier of last resort, and they tell all the states and territories, figure it out for yourself. But in that way, they've been saying that for the last month, month and a half. There, nothing has really changed. I was hoping to see a little bit more federal leadership. Unfortunately, we're not getting it, not from this blueprint.
They called it strategic direction and technical assistance. What does that mean?
It's very hard to tell, Diane. It's very hard to tell. I think instead of strategic direction, we actually need federal involvement. Look, states clearly have to have a very important role, and there's no doubt that states are going to play an important role. But there are certain things that states just cannot do. So there are important supply chain issues that are global supply chain issues. I don't want, you know, state of Delaware or state of Massachusetts going out and cutting deals with China on supply chain. That doesn't make any sense. That's why we have a federal government, is our federal government engages in the global supply chain, not 50 states all competing with each other to try to get testing.
So in terms of numbers, what do you think the numbers of tests should be on a daily basis?
In order to answer that, the key question is, what are we testing for? What's the purpose of testing? And the purpose of testing, just on a very simple level, is what we want to do is we want to be able to identify people who are infected and separate them, isolate them, so that they're not infecting susceptible people. And what that will mean, if we can do that pretty effectively, it will mean that most people who are not infected can go about their daily activities. They can go to a restaurant. They can get coffee at a coffee shop. They can go to work. And in order to pull that off, we have run the numbers, and we think that you need at the bare minimum, you need 500,000 tests a day. I don't know how we can possibly assure Americans that they're going to be reasonably safe going to work, going to a coffee shop, if we're not testing at least that level and possibly more.
Can you give me an idea of how you arrived at that number?
Absolutely. There are many different testing strategies. There are people who suggest we need tens of millions of tests a day, and they envision a life where all of us, any of us on a given morning, wake up and just get a test or go to work and get a test. Our approach was we started with people who have even mild symptoms, because we know a lot of people with COVID will have very mild symptoms. And we said everybody who has mild symptoms that could be COVID ought to get tested right away. Anybody who's positive We need to sit down with them and we need to trace all their contacts. Who have they been with in the previous 5 days, 7 days? And then we need to identify all those people and go test all of them. Because of one of the key things to this disease is that about 25-30% of people are asymptomatic, meaning they have the virus, they're spreading the virus, they're shedding virus, but they have no symptoms. Picking up those people is really, really hard. And the only way that we think you can do it, either you can test hundreds of millions of people every day, or you can do this very aggressive contact tracing. And I think you'll pick up most of those people. So when you run the numbers, people with symptoms, their contacts, you pretty quickly get to 500,000 tests a day. And as I said, maybe even more.
Do we have the capacity in terms of personnel to do the kind of contact tracing you're talking about?
So we don't anymore. You know, we used to have a very robust public health system, but over the last decade, 15 years, we've really cut back on our public health spending. And so most states could not pull off that contact tracing today. You know, the unfortunate news, but the silver lining is, you know, we've had millions of Americans lose their jobs in the last month, Diane. And what that means is you've got a workforce that you can employ very, very quickly. And so states can very quickly identify people who are willing to work, who want to work, who want to be helpful with this disease. And the estimates vary, but, you know, I think we need somewhere between 100 and 300,000 people doing contact tracing across America. Sounds like a large number, but I think we can pretty quickly identify people who have the skills, get them trained up, and get them up and running doing this.
Would it all be done by phone?
So much of it would have to be done by phone because, of course, you don't want to expose these contact tracers to the people who are infected. So the way it would work is, let's say I test positive one morning. Within an hour, I get a call from a contact tracer. That person, you know, does a Zoom call or does a phone call with me for an hour or two, really explains to me why I need to share my contacts, identifies those contacts. There's a lot of interpersonal stuff that goes with this, but it can be done in a way that keeps those contact tracers safe.
It raises the question of those who may have some low-level infection, who don't necessarily report it, but who have the infection and who may spread it by going out in public and nobody knows they have it. So how would anybody be aware? I mean, it seems to me that's pretty scary. I take several walks each day with my small dog. I come across people, some of whom are wearing masks, some of whom are not. I live in a large condominium. How am I to know who has it, perhaps behind closed doors?
So this is the big challenge, because there is so much what we call asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic, meaning a lot of people spread virus before they develop symptoms. And so this is why it's critical to do contact tracing, because the way you're going to identify asymptomatic people or pre-symptomatic people is they're going to spread it to somebody who then might develop symptoms. And when that person gets tested and is identified as being positive, that person's contact list will identify the asymptomatic patient. That's the hope. It doesn't have to work perfectly, and you don't have to get everybody, but you need to get a large enough number that you can slow the infection rate down and keep the number of infected people to a minimum. And if you can do that, then you can give confidence to most people that they can get back to work. But it is going to be challenging, and it will require very vigorous testing in order to be able to do this with any kind of effectiveness.
So what do states need to ramp up testing?
Yeah, so states are struggling with this. And you know, what I see is most states are, of course, committed to trying to ramp up testing. One of the things I've recommended to states is that they get a testing coordinator or a testing czar, and I hate turning every job into a czar job, but somebody who's really responsible for making sure there's enough testing happening in that state. But pretty quickly, states run into barriers that they can't solve themselves. You know, some states are struggling to get enough swabs. Other states are struggling to get enough vials or reagents. And this is where federal help would be so important, because the idea that every state then is going to go out into the marketplace and try to compete with each other for swabs and vials and reagents, that is inefficient. And people say, well, won't the market take care of itself? And the answer is absolutely. If we had 5 years, this would be great. The market would solve this problem. But we don't have 5 years. And this is where you need the full force of the U.S. government to help produce these materials and distribute it to states so states can move this along. So states have an important role to play, but I don't think that states can do it just by themselves.
So talk about the relationship between testing and the ability to open or reopen the economy.
So there's a very simple biology here that is worth understanding. The entire strategy of how to counter this pandemic, until we have a vaccine, is keeping infected people away from susceptible people. That's it. That's the entire strategy. And the reason we had to shut down our economy is we couldn't figure out who was infected and who was susceptible because we just didn't have testing. And the number of infected people got so large, and it was exponential growth, that we had to shut everything down to make sure that infected and susceptible people were separated from each other. As soon as you open up the economy, as soon as you get people back to work, people going to coffee shops, people going to restaurants, infected and susceptible people will start coming in contact with each other. And the infections will take off. Just simple biology, simple math. That is what is going to happen. And the key to making sure it doesn't happen in a way that really lands us in the same place we were in before is to be able to identify as many of those infected people as early as possible and pull them out. Essentially, shelter in place for infected people and regular economic activity for uninfected, susceptible people. That's the strategy. And the only way you know how to differentiate between infected and non-infected people is through testing. We have no other mechanism. So testing isn't everything, but without testing, you've got nothing. And without testing, the only thing you can do is keep your economy shut. And we know that that is massively expensive, both economically and from a health point of view. So if we care about getting our lives back, testing is sort of step number one. Without it, nothing else works.
So what are you saying to the governor of Georgia, for example?
So Governor Kemp has not called me. I have spoken to other governors, but not Governor Kemp. But what I would say to him, if he were to call, is that testing, tracing, isolation works when you don't have a large outbreak. And the point of the national shelter in place was to try to bring the outbreak to a manageable number. And Georgia is not there right now. The number of cases in Georgia is so high that opening up will make it very hard, even if he had the testing capacity, to keep it open. But he doesn't have the testing capacity. So what I'm deeply worried about is, and here's the funniest thing about this disease and this virus, Diane, is that any action you take today, you will not see the effects of it for several weeks. So opening up Georgia now will look totally fine next week or 2 weeks from now. You'll look at it and say, see, it didn't matter. But it will start showing up in the numbers in week 3 and week 4. And by the time it really is taking off, you're behind the eight ball and you have very few tools left. What I am worried about is 5, 6, maybe 8 weeks down the road, Georgia has to shut down again. And so what I would tell Governor Kemp is if you want to keep your economy open, you've got to take a different strategy.
Would you say to him, you've got to do a certain amount of testing before you can reopen that economy? And if so, how much testing would you say Georgia has to do?
First of all, he's got to keep the very restrictive social distancing policies in place for longer. Just because the size of the outbreak in Georgia remains relatively large, and the projections that we've done on a state-by-state basis assume a much smaller outbreak. And so he's got to really drive the number of new infections down much further. And the only way he can do that right now is by maintaining social distancing policies. Then when those numbers come down quite a bit, he's got to use the time between now and then to continue to ramp up testing. And we have specific formulas of exactly how many tests per day each state needs to do based on the size of its outbreak. And so I would suggest to him that he be very evidence-based and data-driven on this, because that's his best shot at protecting the lives of Georgians and of keeping the economy of Georgia going.
Now, what about Governor Mike DeWine in Ohio and what he's doing? I gather he's connected up with a Massachusetts-based firm to get some of the materials he needs to do this kind of testing. How much testing is he going to be able to do on his own? How much does he need to do before he opens that state?
Yeah, so Governor DeWine is in a very different position than Governor Kemp. And that's because Mike DeWine has really been an extraordinarily evidence-based, science-based leader in this entire outbreak and in this entire effort. He closed economic activity down early in Ohio. The number of cases have remained under very good control in Ohio. And that means his testing needs are going to be smaller in Ohio because, again, the size of the outbreak has been much more manageable. I think he's been one of the very top governors in the country if you just measure it based on how science-driven, evidence-based he has been. But even in Ohio, it's just a reminder that despite his what I think is really laudatory leadership, it's hard for him to get everything he needs done on testing by himself. And even there, he's got to reach out to folks in other states. And that's great. That's what we want to see. But, you know, the folks he's trying to get work with in Massachusetts, other states are going to want to try to do that as well. And again, federal coordination on this would be helpful so Governor DeWine isn't out there trying to do this all on his own.
Look at Kansas. Kansas is struggling to come up with the kind of money that it takes to get the equipment they need to do this kind of testing.
Yeah, and a lot of states are gonna struggle. And what's really been interesting to me is Congress has been perfectly willing to write, you know, multi-trillion dollars worth of stimulus and relief. And I think it's right. We should, especially for small businesses, for the poor, for working class people, protecting them during this outbreak is essential. But it has been so much harder to get Congress to write checks that help states do testing. And the irony is, that's what we need to open up our economy again. So instead of just paying to provide relief, if we pay a little bit more, we'll give the resources to states that will allow states to have the resources they need to move forward. Again, that won't be enough. What states need is resources. They need dollars, but they also need the technical expertise. And then they need the power of the federal government, the things that only the federal government can do to compel companies to make more supplies. The states need all of that in order for states to be able to really execute on the testing agenda.
What have other countries succeeded in doing about testing? What have they managed to do that we have not done?
You know, the sort of poster child for this has been South Korea. South Korea early kind of jumped on this disease, substantially ramped up testing. And that has meant that the number of South Koreans who have died has been very small, and that they have been able to manage their outbreak and keep their economy reasonably open in a way that we haven't. There are other examples too, Taiwan, Singapore, who've also done a very good job. And sometimes people say, well, that's just because they had a lot of experience with SARS, and that's why the Europeans and Americans can't quite do this. And I like to point out Germany. So my 500,000 a day, on a per capita basis, Germany's doing about that amount. So it's clearly doable. And Germany's able to do it. And we should be able to do it. So Germany has done a very good job on testing. They, again, they've been aggressive. It isn't like you just testing happens magically. You actually have to focus on it and execute and solve roadblocks. The biggest problem of our federal government's response here has been the just sort of ineptitude, inability to execute on a plan in a way that is really shocking. You know, part of the appeal of President Trump was that he was a businessman who knew how to get things done. And the federal government's ability to get anything done in this pandemic has been really limited. And what we have now in the U.S. is not a single national response, but we have 50 individual responses of 50 states. And running a pandemic response with 50 states all doing their own thing is really not how we get through this easily or effectively. It'd be much better if we really could function as the United States and not 50 disparate states.
More from Dr. Ashish Jha when we come back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Dr. Ashish Jha. He's director of the Harvard Global Health Institute. How far back do you believe this virus actually goes? You know, the president has said, well, we caught it right at the beginning. And yet, it would seem the more we learn that it started much sooner than we thought it did.
Here's what we know, and there's a lot of mystery still because China has not been forthcoming. I think they certainly suppressed a lot of information that made it harder. So my best guess as of right now is that the virus started circulating in Wuhan probably in early November and was almost surely out of China and into other countries by December. And I would not be surprised if we figure out that there were people infected with this virus in December in the U.S. But now we have pretty good evidence that certainly by mid-January, there were many cases within the United States, probably hundreds of cases, if not more. Again, that's a guess based on the evidence, but that's my guess. So by the time we closed the border with China at the end of January, you know, the virus was already in America. And of course, closing borders feels really good and feels like you're doing something useful. But in a globalized economy, what happens is you close the border with China. Imagine that there were no cases in the U.S. by then. You close the border with China. Well, Chinese people and travelers from China are going to go to Europe. They'll infect people in Europe. And then people from Europe will come to the United States. So all it does at most is buys you a little bit of time. Unless you go into complete lockdown and shut your country off from the rest of the world forever, which is not a good strategy, it is not possible to build walls or do travel bans and protect the country. At most, they buy you a few extra days, maybe a week or two. The key question is, how do you use that time? Do you use that time to prepare, in which case a travel ban can be useful? Or do you use that time to essentially feel good about the travel ban and do nothing else, in which case you probably accomplish very little? And unfortunately here, I feel like we accomplish very little with those travel bans.
How early do you believe officials here in this country realized that the virus was on the loose in the U.S.?
Well, certainly, I think by mid-January, people here had a pretty good idea that the virus was here or about to arrive and really start creating problems. And we can see that now from a lot of the reports of the federal government. And I would say by late January, it was clear to almost all of us that this was going to end up being a big problem in the U.S. I wrote a piece at the end of January talking about this, but other people wrote before I did and saw it before I did. I'd say by mid to late January, most public health officials were starting to get very, very worried.
What could have been done as early as mid to late January to somehow mitigate what's happened.
Yeah, so this is the most tragic part of this. You know, as we get past 50,000 Americans who have died and the numbers are climbing on a daily basis, it's really stunning to think what this could have been if we had acted differently. So let's imagine an alternative scenario where mid-January, the federal government decided to take this seriously by kind of, I don't remember the exact day, but like January 17th, 18th, we had a diagnostic test. WHO had a diagnostic test that they were offering to countries around the world. Let's say we had taken that test or we had built one ourselves that actually had worked and then used the rest of January to ramp up testing. We would have discovered by the end of January, early February, that there were cases in New York, cases in California, in Washington State, and we could have started identifying those people and isolating them. We could have brought the disease outbreak under control. Instead of flying blind as we did for the entire month of February and letting the virus take root and take off in this country, we could have gotten ahead of it. And I think by March, instead of having to shut down our economy, we could have ended up in a place like South Korea did, where we could have kept our economy open. Maybe a few spots would have had to have short periods of shutdown, but we could have kept going and we would have had far fewer deaths. All of this was preventable. All of it was expected and predicted, and it was complete willful, I don't know about willful, I shouldn't ascribe motivations, but it was complete negligence on part of the federal leadership that they decided to ignore every warning sign and have brought this upon the American people. It's a travesty.
Can you help me to understand what was wrong with the WHO testing and why the CDC rejected it?
So there was nothing wrong with the WHO test kit. In fact, it's the one that most countries have used. Most of the European countries have used it. There's nothing wrong with it.
Well, it works. Why didn't we use it?
We can now. But the problem is we could have done it. But here's the interesting part, Diane. It's not unreasonable to initially have said, you know what, we'll build our own. We have a long history of building our own test kits. And, you know, mid-January, the CDC says we'll build our own. I would have said that's fine. But then as soon as it became obvious that the CDC test kit wasn't working, we should have immediately gone back to the WHO's test kit, gotten it. And then if we wanted to fix our own, that's fine, but at least we had a backup plan. But instead of that, we spent a month, and it's even worse than that. What happened was not only did we reject the WHO test kit, not only did we fail to create our own, but then when private labs said, we will build a test kit, we said, the federal government said no. And prevented private labs from building test kits. And so for a month, no one could really build testing. I'm simplifying it a little bit, but not that much.
Can you explain why the federal government said no? Were the reasons economic? Were the reasons one of pride? What were the reasons?
So it's hard to be sure. I can tell you the specifics, and then I can give you some conjecture on what the larger issue is. The specifics are that there were regulations put in place. Those regulations have existed for a long time. That says in the middle of an emergency, if you want to build a test, you have to go through some regulatory hurdles. I understand those regulations. They're not unreasonable. But basically, they were applied in a way that made it very, very hard for anybody to build a test. And people were yelling and screaming and saying, we were trying to build the test, and the federal government was tone deaf, was not responsive. They would take weeks to get back to people. They just wasted an enormous amount of time. Now, it's easy to say, well, it's just regulatory hurdles. I actually think the broader problem is that there was a very strong desire in the White House to not scare the markets and not frighten kind of economic confidence. And they believed that if you act like it doesn't exist, if you don't look for it, it will magically go away. It was a tragic misreading of what an epidemic does. And it was a complete ignoring of all the science that said, like a fire that you hide under the bed, hoping that the fire goes out on its own, you know, and choosing not to look for a disease that is spreading in your community that will kill tens of thousands of people is not a strategy for pandemics. And yet that was the strategy that they appear to employ. And we are unfortunately all suffering as a result.
Dr. Jha, I want to ask your reaction to the president's suggestion that people could swallow some kind of bleach to rid themselves of this virus, and the reaction not only from you but around the country from doctors to that statement.
It's obviously deeply irresponsible. And and we saw in the days that followed, unfortunately, a lot of people try things like that and hurt themselves. As a general rule, it's good to avoid getting medical advice from politicians. But in this case, particularly when people are scared, people are nervous, anxious about this pandemic, we have to be particularly thoughtful about how we advise people, what we say to them. And if he has his pet theories of what could work, that's fine. He can share them confidentially with his medical advisors. But to stand up in front of the American people and pontificate on these things is both deeply irresponsible and incredibly harmful. And you know what it does, Diane, is it distracts us from the issues at hand. So we spend time talking about telling people don't swallow Lysol, don't inject bleach, instead of how do we get more testing? How do we build up an army of contact tracers? How do we open up our economy safely? That's the conversation we need to be having as a country. And instead, we have to spend our time telling people not to do very, very harmful things because the president thought it might be a good idea.
And what was your reaction to the reaction of Dr. Birx, his medical advisor, sitting there as he said this?
You know, I have known Dr. Birx for a long time. Debbie Birx is one of the smartest, most effective public health leaders in our country. And I watched the pain on her face. And, you know, I want to take a minute to talk about a lot of people in the public health world are feeling very frustrated with Dr. Birx because they've been arguing that she has not done enough to denounce comments of his. And I think that's unfair. I can't imagine what pressure she's in every day. And all I can say is thank goodness Debbie Birx and Tony Fauci are there because they are doing God's work and they are keeping the country safe. And the idea that Dr. Birx would stand up and denounce the president is unrealistic. It would not work. She would get fired and we'd all be worse off for it. So I think she's doing a very good job trying to walk a very fine line. And, you know, it's very easy for me to armchair quarterback every decision she makes and say, oh, she should have said this or not. I think she's doing a great job, and I'm just thankful she's there.
Do you think Dr. Fauci is still there?
I do think Dr. Fauci is still there, and I think he is doing a fabulous job as well. And the reason I think Dr. Fauci is still there, I've known Tony Fauci actually much longer than I've known Dr. Birx. I've known Tony Fauci for 20 some odd years. He's a legend, of course. He was very famous even before he became famous in this way. And I can see his fingerprints in some of the policy things that have come out of the White House. And I think, thank goodness, I can still see it. I can read it. I know he's there and he's influencing. Obviously, I wish he had more influence. I wish he was running the national response. We'd all be better for it. But he's there, he's shaping policy, maybe not as much as we'd like. And again, I say every day, thank goodness he's there and doing incredible work.
One last thing I haven't asked you about, which is antibody testing.
Yeah.
What about antibody testing? Is it as necessary as people are saying it is?
There's a lot of excitement about antibody testing, and there's a bit of magical thinking about antibody testing. So let me explain what it is useful for and what it is not useful for. I, as a public health person, am very excited about antibody testing because it is going to teach me a lot about the spread of the disease. So when we have good antibody testing, and I'll talk about the quality of these tests, we'll be able to know how far widespread has this disease been, how many people have been asymptomatic carriers, how many people have actually been infected, and how far along are we on this disease curve. That's really vital information. There are two issues. One is, remember I told you that for a month, the FDA really stopped the ability of the country to do any testing. So as a response, because they got such criticism, now they basically have allowed anybody who has developed a test to start selling their tests in America. So, Diane, you and I could go into a business of creating our own, the Cha-Reem test of antibodies, and we wouldn't even have to prove to anybody that it was any good, and we could start selling it. They have become now too lax. And that has meant there are dozens and dozens of antibody tests out there, and many of them are of very poor quality. So one issue is we've got to get the quality right, or you're going to give a lot of false positives and negatives. The second issue that is every bit as important is that we are assuming that if you have antibodies, that you are immune from reinfection. That may be true. I'm hoping that's true. But I don't have scientific evidence that that is true. And until we do, we should not be assuming that just because you have antibodies, because if that assumption turns out to be wrong, there are a lot of people walking around who are going to get reinfected and end up getting sick and maybe even dying. So we have to let the science catch up with the magical thinking. And at some point, it might be that we find that antibodies do protect people in a way that is robust, at which point antibody testing will be really, really important in other ways. But right now, we just have to learn more about what these things mean.
Is there anything further you'd like to say before we close?
Yeah, you know, the thing that I think your listeners ought to understand is while there is a lot of uncertainty about this virus, it's a new virus, none of us have encountered it before, there is very broad consensus in the public health community, public policy community about what we have to do. Until we have a vaccine, which is a good 12 to 18 months away, we have to maintain some level of social distancing. We can't be going to baseball games. That just is probably not a good idea. And we have to ramp up testing and tracing and isolation. That's it. And while we're working on vaccines and therapies, if we can do those things, we can get much of our lives back. And so what I plead to people is don't get distracted by the random noise of the day. Keep your eyes on the prize. Maintain social distancing, ramp up testing, tracing, and isolation, and we can get a lot of our life back. And that's what we all care about. And I think that politicians who distract us from that are causing more harm than good. But there's a lot of us who are working on those things, and we really need the American people behind us, and we need the American public to hold their politicians accountable for delivering on those things.
Dr. Jha, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on, Diane.
That was Dr. Ashish Jha, director of the Harvard Global Health Institute. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to let me know what you want me to cover during this very difficult time. Please continue to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. I hope you stay well and stay safe. I'm Diane Ring.